Welcome to Ask a Doctor, what your doctor wants you to know with Dr. Virgie. Over the next hour, you'll learn valuable medical tips from health policy to personal finance and medical debt management. Now listen close and welcome your host, Dr. Virgie Bright Ellington.
To find out what your dermatologist wants you to know, I reached out to Dr. Dina Strawn. Dr. Strawn is a Harvard undergraduate alumni, earned her medical degree from Yale Medical School, and is a UCSF, University of California, San Francisco trained, board certified dermatologist with a bi-coastal New York City and Los Angeles virtual practice. Dr. Strawn is also the owner of a Glow Dermatology, a private dermatology practice in Manhattan. She also has a great blog, I have to say, packed with tons of awesome information, aglowdermatology.com. So, Dr. Dina, first, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
It's my pleasure.
So we've known each other a long time, and I know we shouldn't be dating each other. It's been more than 20 years. Don't get mad at me for dating us. But you know, I think you're one of the very smartest people on earth. Definitely over the past 20 years, you're still one of the smartest people I've ever met in person.
I'm
really interested in hearing your opinion. What does your dermatologist want you to know?
Well, there are so many things that your dermatologist would want you to know, but I'm going to narrow it down to three for this time, because we don't have all day. But I'd say number one, I would start with that dry skin is not a vanity issue, and applying lotion is not just a cosmetic issue. Dry skin is actually a health issue, and not just for your skin.
Why is that? Why is it not just a vanity issue? And, as some of us like to say, I'm ashy, I need to put on lotion. Why is it not just a vanity issue?
Well, if you think about it, like, your skin is your largest organ, and it has a function. It protects you from the outside world. It keeps your fluid levels normal. So it has a function. And when your skin is dry, it creates a lot of inflammation in the body. And I'm sure you've heard people talk about inflammation for a variety of health things. You know, there are people talk about low inflammatory diets.
That's right.
Well, when you're creating all this inflammation, it affects many of skin diseases like eczema, psoriasis, even acne, where people think there's a benefit from being dry. Acne is an inflammatory skin disease.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So the inflammation makes your acne worse. But it's not even just those skin diseases. It actually can affect other organ systems, other diseases. Have you heard about the connection between, your dental health and heart health?
Absolutely. So they talk about periodontal disease, gum disease. The low-grade inflammation is enough to significantly increase your risk for sudden cardiac death, myocardial infarctions. Absolutely.
Yeah. So imagine those are your gums, the skin right. covers your whole body and it creates a lot of inflammation. And so we also naturally get drier with age. So in our 20s, we start to lose antioxidants in our skin. And then 30s and 40s, collagen, elastin. And then when you hit your 50s, your skin has a harder time keeping the water in it, right? So it starts to get dry and it gets inflamed. So where I trained in San Francisco, they did a study looking at the inflammatory markers in the blood of people who were in their mid-30s versus people in their 50s. And they found that they were much higher in people in their 50s. So they did an experiment where they just had people in their 50s start to apply lotion every day, a moisturizer every day for a month. And then they checked their blood levels again, and the inflammation in their blood had gone down to the levels of someone in their mid-30s just by applying moisturizer.
That's incredible. That's astounding. So just like regular lotion, folks in their 50s start applying regular lotion every day, not some prescription formulated, lotion, just over the counter, just plain old
They used a specific moisturizer that was like a Korean moisturizer. I don't know exactly what was in it, but it was just a, they used a moisturizer, a specific one. So that
it wasn't a prescription. It was something that you could find over the counter.
Yes.
Just in your regular drugstore, right on the shelves. Yeah.
Yes. And so that's amazing because, you know,
that is incredible.
Yeah. In addition to gum disease affecting heart disease, the inflammation, I mean, inflammation is being tied to all sorts of other health problems, cancer, multiple sclerosis, dementia, all sorts of things. That's a big area being explored. And just think about it. We're packaged in this large organ, our skin, and it can be contributing to those problems and we don't even know.
You know, that's huge, Dr. Strawn. Like you said, you know, the skin is our largest organ. It is the largest organ in our whole body. And it is the barrier from the outside world to protect our inside world, you know, to keep us healthy from the bad things outside. So if it is, if it gets broken, you know, microabrasions from dry skin, inflammation, there you go. You know, so that study at UCSF, you know, demonstrating that, you know, showing that, wow, just, you know, with dry skin, the microabrasions and the little minute opening to the outside world, that inflammation in itself gets into your bloodstream. And that is your, oh my gosh,
it causes inflammation in your blood.
It gets in your bloodstream. That's every place. That's your whole body. That's you. So that is absolutely incredible. And just a month of applying lotion, moisturizer every day reverses it from the levels down to that you see in a 30-year-old. That is absolutely outstanding. Yeah. Amazing.
And then also, you know, this is unrelated to that, but again, it's back to dry skin. When the public health law, I believe it was in New York first, where they required hand sanitizer in the hospitals. Do you know why that was so?
I thought this was back in the day to prevent disease spreading in, you know, people unfortunately not washing their hands as rigorously as they should, vigilantly as they should, back in the day to prevent infection between patients in the hospitals.
Well, it was actually because people weren't washing their hands that they required hand sanitizer. Washing your skin a lot strips all the oil out of your skin and it becomes dry. And then that creates these micro breaks in the skin that can get colonized by bacteria. So finding that people who were washing their hands a lot and their skin barrier was getting compromised were actually able to spread infection more.
Oh my gosh, that makes absolute sense. Oh my gosh. Oh, I did not know that. I did not know that's the reason why hand sanitizer was implemented as required in hospitals.
Yeah. Wow. So moisturizing your skin, like having your skin be healthy, it's not just about pretty. You know, I have the saying, healthy skin is beautiful skin, because what is healthy in your skin is what we perceive as beautiful, right?
Yes.
But, you know, your skin getting dry, we don't consider that as beautiful, but that's also not healthy. That's a sign, hey, you know, if it's the vanity that inspires us to address it, then we get better health.
Whatever it takes,
whichever
right?
Whichever it is, but we should use a moisturizer. And the moisturizer might be different depending on the time of year and where you live. Like, did you know how much where you live affects your need to moisturize?
You know what, Dr. Strawn, I thought that it was just if you lived in cold weather climates, during cold weather, you need to be extra aggressive about moisturizing and using super moisturizing lotions and creams and ointments even.
Yeah, and in colder climates, people tend to get drier. Of course, you can be, you know, someplace like Arizona where it's very dry, or Southern California where it tends to be dry. And, you know, some people flare up there. So when I trained in San Francisco, there was a very large Filipino population, and a lot of those people would come in, you know, complaining of eczema, and they said that they didn't have a family history. And that's a condition that's, you know, very genetically driven. But when you think about it, if they were a recent immigrant from the Philippines, their family had been in this super humid environment, which is usually good for eczema. Some people flare in humidity. So it wasn't until they came to relatively arid California that they started to have those skin conditions. So people just have to be aware that, you know, the environment will affect it. When the seasons change will affect how dry your skin is, how many times you take a bath or shower. So again, taking too many baths or showers, too much hot water can dry out your skin. Too much soap can dry out your skin. Unless you're really dirty, you don't need to lather up your whole body every day. Mm-hmm. Face, neck, armpits, groin, buttocks. If you're dirty, use something there. But you can really, the water does a lot of the cleaning.
Okay.
And when you get out of
Go ahead. You were going to say something?
And when you get out of the bath or shower, that's the best time to apply your moisturizer.
It helps occlude the moisturizer, the water, and it helps occlude, it's an occlusive mechanism to help pack in the water, the moisture.
Yeah, that it's like a sponge. You just soaked that sponge in water, and now you're going to seal it in so it doesn't
evaporate. Seal it in with lipophilic barrier, right? So water does not want to cross fat. So that's where the moisturizer occludes the water in your skin and creates a nice moisture cap for the skin.
Yes.
Good stuff. Now, I was going to ask, what are your thoughts about folks recommending that they not shower every single day in the winter in cold climates? That they not shower or bathe every single day? Do you think that it's healthier for the skin for this issue of dryness and, you know, microabrasions, you know, that increase the risk of inflammation or increases, frankly, inflammation? Do you think that it's better to not bathe and or shower every day, especially in the colder climates?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're, you know, at a time where everyone wants to be very clean. And of course, that depends if you're going out and coming back into your home or staying home all day. But definitely reducing the number of baths or showers helps, because you're not stripping the lipid barrier off of your skin. And that's what happens when you soap up and get in the bath or shower.
Got it. Good stuff. Good stuff. Is there anything else that your dermatologist wants you to know, Dr. Strawn?
This is one of my personal pet peeves, because I see a lot of hair loss patients. Mm. And that's if you have hair loss, before you start treating, you should get a diagnosis. And hair loss equals alopecia. Alopecia itself isn't a diagnosis.
Mm, important point.
Yeah. So, and I see a lot of patients who come in who've seen doctors, or they've been treated. They're complaining of hair loss, and they come in and I ask them, well, what have you been getting treated with? What kind of hair loss do you have? And they just tell me alopecia. And alopecia just means hair loss. It's the fancy word.
Great.
And you know why that's important? It's like saying somebody has an infection.
Yeah.
And you're going to treat their infection and you don't know what kind it is.
Right. You don't know what the cause of the infection is. Exactly.
Yeah. Is it a virus? Exactly. Is it a bacterial infection?
Right.
Is it a yeast infection? Is it a parasite?
Right.
And so you just give everybody the same thing. You give everybody penicillin. Is it sensitive to penicillin? So that's, and you know, one of the reasons is that, you know, hair, even though it is not a vital organ, we are social animals and hair is very important and it's a reflection of our health and it has a lot of social significance. Mm. So people are very motivated to address hair loss. And if you don't know what you're treating, you can get taken advantage of.
Yes.
Financially.
Absolutely.
And then you can not treat something. Some types of hair loss, when they progress, they're permanent and irreversible. So if you don't catch it, then you can't get your hair back because you've been treating it the wrong way. And then hair loss can be a sign of a medical problem. And so you can miss that.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate to have someone come in telling you that they've had alopecia for years. And when you find the underlying problem, if they come to you years ago when it first started, it would have been treatable and reversible, could have been reversible at that time, but now it's permanent. The hair salt, hair cells, follicle cells are permanently damaged and gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I've actually been surprised in the years I've been practicing at the number of people who might have a diagnosis of what we call a scarring hair loss, meaning there's a potential that the hair follicles will be scarred up and damaged, that we've been able to reverse it with treatment and that they would get a significant amount of hair regrowth that I wouldn't have even expected. Wow. So, you know, that makes it even more important to me to make sure that people don't waste time doing the wrong treatment and that they see a, you know, a board certified dermatologist who has expertise in hair loss, because dermatology is skin, hair, and nails, but not everybody has as much expertise in hair. And also ethnically, it makes a difference. Not everyone is as familiar with the type of hair loss that certain ethnic groups experience, because the hair is different and the diseases are different. And so it's important that someone is familiar with that. But you should really get a diagnosis. You particularly want to know if it's scarring or non-scarring. It's not just an issue of take these vitamins, like, you know, and even dermatologists can be guilty of this sometimes, where people start focusing on treatments such as PRP, which is platelet-rich plasma.
Oh my
plasma,
goodness. Which, are they, you know, doing this universally?
Well, you know, that can boost some hair growth, but it's not necessarily a treatment or addressing why someone has hair loss, but the person doing it, it's very lucrative.
Yes.
So suddenly there's all this interest in, I treat hair loss, by lots of healthcare providers in and outside of my specialty. PRP, PRP. They start chasing people with the needle with the PRP.
Absolutely.
But they never diagnosed the patient.
Absolutely.
And they didn't, didn't go through the treatment options.
Yeah, the problem with PRP is that platelet-rich plasma is that it's not covered by insurance companies. It's considered experimental and investigational for the indication of hair loss for alopecia and many, many other diagnoses and medical problems. And so the point is that it is a cash cow. So, yeah. You know, it's very lucrative, like you said. So it tends to be, because it can be effective, as you pointed out, the treatment is given without looking at the underlying cause, the diagnosis, the etiology or cause of the problem, of the alopecia, of the hair loss.
And just because something isn't covered doesn't mean it doesn't work.
That's right. Know?
Yeah, it can work. There are lots of things that we do off-label. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the standard of care is off-label, you know, for treatments. But I just think people should be a little bit more mindful that if that's all they're being offered, or if they're all you're being offered are vitamins by these supplements, you know, supplements can be helpful if you are deficient. Definitely, there are lots of nutritional deficiencies, zinc, protein that are associated with hair loss. And, you know, sometimes supplements can just help, like changing the soil on a plant.
Mm.
You know, I've had people just take them for a few months, and it would be interesting that it didn't really address their alopecia, their hair loss, but when they came back, the rest of their hair did look more lush, you know, like when you change the soil on a plant. So I used to be a little bit more skeptical because, you know, our food supply isn't as high quality as it had been. This is something that we hear a lot of research, you know, a tomato in our century is not the same as a tomato 50 years ago in terms of the nutrients.
Yep.
So, and nutrition is just, you know, it's so complex. So there could be micronutrients and other nutrients that we're not getting, even if we think we eat a really healthy diet, and that would affect your hair. But if that's all that's being pushed at you, PRP, nutrients, or just steroid injections. Some people just get steroid injections and it just come back more steroid injections. And steroid injections can be very effective if you have inflammatory hair loss, because the steroid calms down the inflammation. People are very scared of steroids, but we have steroids in our body and they do some good things.
That's
and they're different
right.
types of steroids.
Right.
But I feel that when all that's happening is that they're just, someone's just coming in endlessly like an annuity for steroid injections without discussing, you know, other ways to manage and other things that need to be done to stimulate hair regrowth. That it they're not really getting down to what is going on.
Dr. Strawn, is the only way to get a diagnosis, for instance, let's say that the diagnosis of an inflammatory etiology or cause of the alopecia, is that only determined by and able to be determined by a biopsy of this of the scalp? Let's say that, you know what, I go into a dermatologist who tells me that my hair loss, my alopecia, is caused from an inflammatory problem, and they recommend regular steroid injections. What do you think about that? Meaning, can you make a diagnosis without doing a biopsy and looking at the scalp cells under a microscope? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. I mean, diagnosing hair loss is a lot more complex than people think. And there can be like probably half the population at some time normally will experience hair loss. It's just part of the human evolution trajectory. There was a study I saw at a meeting once. It was a poster out of Japan that just showed that after like 25 or 27, people's hair volume just went down a bit. And it's not pathology. It's just what happens, right? But how a diagnosis is made for hair loss, first of all, you know, assuming somebody's trained and knows how to diagnose hair loss, you take a history, you do a physical exam, and then after that, what you're thinking will direct whether or not you get blood tests or whether or not you do a biopsy.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie, on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
I have some exciting news. I wrote a book, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know to Crush Medical Debt, comes out May 19th. But you can head over to Amazon or barnesandnobles.com and pre-order a copy today. But what would be a book launch without some parties, right? So join me tomorrow, Friday, April 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, for our Crush Medical Debt book celebration happy hour, where I'm giving away Visa gift cards to help you pay for your debt, as well as making a big announcement. See you there tomorrow, Friday, April 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
So, you know, hair loss can be from outside things. Is your hair breaking? When your hair breaks, that's hair loss. That doesn't mean I have to do a biopsy and order thousands of dollars of blood tests.
Right.
If I know how to evaluate that, and you know, we do a thing like hair pull test. Does the hair break when I pull on it, or does it come out by the roots? What are the person's personal hygiene practices? those sorts of things, their other underlying medical history, their family history. So you do not have to do a biopsy, but if there's confusion, do a biopsy. I mean, I do biopsies. I actually started to do fewer biopsies the more expert I got, because I felt more confident in making the diagnosis. But I do biopsies sometimes, usually when I'm like, I don't feel confident. I'm going to do a biopsy, and I find something different than what I'm expecting. So, you know, it's a tool, but it's not the thing. And, you know, sometimes if someone biopsies in the wrong place,
good point.
Depending on the cycle, for example, you know, how something is cycling.
Yep.
If you have a hair loss that is burnt out, meaning it's dead, like, you know, it's like a fire, the house is burned down, you know, it's just ash. You can't necessarily tell why that happened.
You're not going to see the cellular changes under the microscope that caused the pathology, that caused the problem, that caused the loss, the alopecia.
Exactly. It's just going to be end stage.
Yeah.
Or if just something
dead cells. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Something could be when you get
atrophy cells,
not showing the pathology when you take the sample. So it's a tool. It's a tool. But certainly, if it's going on and you don't feel confident that the person knows what you have, it's not just a matter of your thyroid studies are normal.
Right.
You know, right. Or you need to take vitamins.
Right.
You know, there must be nothing. I mean, if your hair's falling out, it's falling out. So just because your thyroid study is normal doesn't mean that you don't have a problem. I identify people who have, you know, they don't have necessarily a diagnosis of lupus, but they might have a very positive ANA, anti-nuclear antibody study, which can be associated with a lot of autoimmune diseases. Mm-hmm. Or with the thyroid, a lot of times people will have normal thyroid studies, but someone didn't check their thyroid autoantibodies. And personally, that's what I find more. I find more elevated thyroid autoantibodies. And these are, you know, antibodies that are attacking your thyroid gland, your own thyroid gland, more so than I find abnormal thyroid function studies.
So Dr. Strawn, when should I come to see a dermatologist when I'm thinking, you know what, this hair loss is just from getting older, what we call androgenic alopecia, you know, in the crown, I've gotten older, you know, I may be past menopause or perimenopausal. Maybe this is just part of age. How can I tell that it's part of normal aging or not? And at what point should I see a dermatologist to make sure this is not just normal aging, hair loss from normal aging?
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, what we call normal aging, androgenetic alopecia is the most common cause of alopecia, and people just think of it as normal, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, when I ask patients about their family history, sometimes they say that no one in their family has hair loss. And then I might ask specifically, I said, really? I said, even your father, the men, well, my brothers are bald, you know, normal balding. That actually is a condition. We can have a lot of things that are conditions that get worse with age, but is it normal aging? It's just a condition. It's, you know, not a big deal. It's not going to, you know, necessarily reduce your life expectancy, but you know, there have been studies that people with androgenetic alopecia have an increased risk of heart disease.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know that treating the androgenetic alopecia is necessarily going to correct that, but that could be a marker to know, wow, maybe I should be a little bit more vigilant about following up with my annual visits if I have this condition.
Would that be something that's more like not causal, but correlated with, meaning if you have androgenic alopecia, you're likely to be in your 50s or older. You
it
can be in your 50s
earlier.
Or older. So.
No, it starts earlier.
It starts earlier. So 30s, 40s.
It can start in the teens and after puberty. But
oh, wow. Anytime after puberty.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had relatives, male relatives who lost their hair by the time they're in their 20s. You know, 21, you know, they significantly had a very receding hairline as early as 21.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a condition. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't mean it's necessarily a dangerous condition, and it might be a common condition. So normal aging, if you have that in your family, some people die at 90 with a full head of thick hair.
Yeah.
So I'd say is, you know, as soon as you have a concern, I mean, cause you know, there are things that can be done even for normal aging or, you know, okay. hair loss, androgenetic alopecia. I mean, uh-huh. it affects people's, you know, mental health, emotional health, especially women, cause women get it too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd say I think it's reasonable to get it checked out to make sure that's what it is.
Okay.
I mean, a lot of times people don't because, you know, it's in their family and they're usually right because that's the most common thing and it's in their family and I'm, you know, balding like dad did. But I mean, if you have a concern, why not just verify, make sure it's not something else. I mean, I've had patients that at first glance, I was thinking androgenetic alopecia, but there was something a little off about it. And so I did a blood test workup and, you know, the person had syphilis, you know what I mean?
Oh my gosh.
And it was a very close call.
Oh, wow.
But it was those little things.
Yes.
That were just a little, I was like,
Yeah. Wow. So it presented as alopecia, hair loss that was androgenic. What we thought was androgenic alopecia, and you know, syphilis shows up, you know, it's shows up in the skin. So this person didn't have any skin lesions. They just had the hair loss was the only sign.
Well, that's all the person told me about.
Okay. Gotcha. Got it. Understand. Got it.
So I don't know if something had happened. Maybe there hadn't been a sore. Maybe that's why the person came in. Maybe the person was worried.
Yeah. So with the syphilis lesions, you know, they're there and then they go away. And so people are like, oh, I'm good. It went away. It was no big deal. But it's in the back of their mind. What was that thing? And then the hair loss in this case was the excuse to go in, the cover to go in to say, well, this is what's going on. And then, well, if I get blood tests, maybe I'll see if there's anything else wrong.
You know? Yeah. Well, you know, fun fact, until like the mid 20th century, the American Academy of Dermatology was called the American Academy of Dermatology and Syphilology.
Oh, I totally believe that, but I didn't know that. But because until like the 50s, the 1950s?
I'm not sure about when exactly, but I've seen volumes of old journals, and that was dermatology and syphilology. And that's because syphilis is, you know, it's like leprosy, the great masquerader. It shows up on your skin.
Yep.
It affects your whole body. It's not just a sexually transmitted disease. Yep. You know, you can get neurosyphilis.
Yep.
It can cause blindness, all those things. So in dermatology, that's one of the things that we have to be very well educated about. And I don't know if you know, but I started out as an AIDS dermatologist.
I didn't remember that. Dr. Strong, was that back in your days when you were at Drew in LA?
It was in San Francisco. San Francisco, I started.
Yeah.
And my residency was in the middle of the AIDS epidemic before there was heart therapy. And so I remember, I think it was my last year of training, my first year of residency. That was my specialty, HIV dermatology. The skin is your largest immune organ.
Yes. As you discussed, as you pointed out, as we learned. Yeah.
So there would be many, many things showing up on the skin. And so often we might be the people to actually identify that someone was HIV positive for the first time.
Wow.
But with respect to syphilis, you know, secondary syphilis, so people are more familiar with the sore that someone might get on their genitals if they acquired it sexually, but that will go away, but then they'll start to get all sorts of skin manifestations. And one of them is hair loss.
Wow.
So it's something you have to keep in your mind. And so one year, I think in California, I think I personally diagnosed 10% of the syphilis cases because it had gone away for a while.
Yes.
And then it popped back up.
Right.
And so I was seeing a more high risk patient population. And when I looked up the stats, I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
So the dermatologist, I mean, as a dermatologist, I was identifying 10% of the cases in the state. It was kind of weird. So it's not just Botox and bonbons.
Incredible. That's amazing. Yeah. You know, I always say you're one of the, I can count on less than one hand, the number of people that I really wish I knew their IQ. And Dr. Dina Strano is always one of them. She's just so amazing. The stuff that she just puts together and clarifies for us, you know, for everyone is just wonderful. Just amazing. Good stuff. Good stuff. I'm learning tons. I always learn from talking with you. Is there anything else your dermatologist wants you to know, Dr. Strawn? Anything else you'd like us to know?
Well, this is just sort of basic skincare, but some people might not know it, is that we really should wear sunscreen, at least on our face. And if you live someplace sunny where you're exposed, on those parts that are exposed daily, even if you are indoors, where you have large windows or you're driving, because the ultraviolet light, you know, the main two players with respect to skin cancer and aging are UVA rays, which are the longer wavelengths, and you can think of it as UV aging, and then UVB is
great way to remember. Great tip for remembering. Yes,
and then UVB is the one that varies more with the weather. So it'll go up in the summer. It'll go up closer to the equator. And you can think of that as UV burning. That'll give you a sunburn.
Oh, and that's, you know, the good one tip. Great way to remember.
More associated with skin cancer as well. But over time, even though the UVA is, at normal environmental levels, doesn't tend to be the main player, over time, it increases your risk of skin cancer and aging, and it penetrates glass. So, you know, if you're driving, or I have a huge window where I live and I like to sit by it like a cat, but you know, I'm aware I'm getting UVA all day. The UVB isn't getting through. I'm not burning. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting ultraviolet light. So if you do that, like we discussed earlier, there are photos. You knew of a photo of a truck driver, and I knew one of a typist in France for I believe it was L'Oreal, presents it at our scientific conferences, where half of their faces, your truck driver, half of his face on the left was wrinkled, and the right side was smooth. And in the case I know about, the typist, she just worked there for decades, sat at the same chair, sat next to a window, half of her face was wrinkled and half of her face was smooth. And it was just from what came through the window.
Yeah, that story, Dr. Strawn, is the biggest poster child for advocating for all of us to wear sunscreen every day. This is part of our regular skincare and hygiene routine.
And even for people of color, we have a much less risk of skin cancer. But there are things that happen to the skin. We do get sun damage. We do start to get spots. I call dark spots the fine line of dark skin, because we're less likely to get, you know, fine wrinkles, but we might get dark spots, which cosmetically people don't like. We're more prone to melasma, which is something you tend to see more in women related to pregnancy or birth control. But people continuously get these dark patches. You see it a lot in, you know, India, the Caribbean. I saw a lot of women with it in Portugal. So women who are kind of brown in complexion, in California, Southern California, especially, tons of melasma. And they get these dark patches. So they don't like it, and it's hard to manage. So for a variety of reasons, and also, you know, people can be on medications that make them more photosensitive. A lot of people have a lupus, which can be triggered by ultraviolet light. That's another disease that's on the skin a lot.
You know, what I remembered about, what I learned about sun exposure and UV light, and particularly UVB, in folks that have a lot of melanin, higher melanin, those of us with brown skin, is that we tend not to get the fine wrinkles from the UVB. I'm sorry, UVA. I'm getting my UV terms, acronyms mixed up. The UVA in folks who have more melanin don't get the fine wrinkles. They get the deep wrinkles, the deep kind of dermal, deep skin folding and wrinkles from skin sun exposure, UVA rays, compared to folks with less melanin. They get the finer wrinkles and earlier in life. Is that your finding also? Am I remembering that correctly?
You are. That they again, another picture of a, I think it was an African American truck driver down south. And he was probably a skin type 6, a darker skin type, and had like atrophy almost on the left side of his face, the cheek that was getting exposed to the sun through the window more compared to the rim.
This is good stuff, Dr. Strawn. You know, I can talk to you forever. You know, I've been talking to you for years, and I'm still looking to figure out how to get with Dr. Strawn and talk to Dr. Dina some more, get some more valuable, just good stuff. So
I confess I'm a derm nerd.
I wouldn't say a derm nerd, but maybe a derm genius, but you know. So where can folks go to check out your skincare shelf?
Well, they can check out my Instagram and look for my Shop My Shelf. Okay. And my Instagram is at Dr. Dina MD. That's DrDinaMD. They can also go to my practice website. That's aglowdermatology.com, AGLOW dermatology.com. And, you know, they can follow the blog. So even if you can't come see me in New York, you can check out my blog because there's a lot of information there. And then also you can, you know, check out some of the products I recommend there.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Dr. Dina, for taking the time to talk with me today. You know, I always love talking to you. It's been awesome. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie on the Voice America Health and Wellness channel. We'll be back after this short break.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
I have some exciting news. I wrote a book, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know to Crush Medical Debt, comes out May 19th. But you can head over to Amazon or BarnesandNobles.com and pre-order a copy today. But what would be a book launch without some parties, right? So join me tomorrow, Friday, April 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, for our Crush Medical Debt book celebration happy hour, where I'm giving away Visa gift cards to help you pay for your debt, as well as making a big announcement. See you there tomorrow, Friday, April 29th, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, at crushmedicaldebt.com.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Ask a Doctor, What Your Doctor Wants You to Know with Dr. Virgie. If you have a question for Dr. Virgie or her guests, you can email Dr. Virgie at dr.virgie@crushmedicaldebt.com. Now back to the show. Here again is Dr. Virgie.
Welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. On today's episode of What Your Medical Debt Doctor Wants You to Know, we're going to talk about the number one thing you can do to save your financial life. No exaggeration. The number one thing you can do
to save your financial life is to stop signing electronic pads. Stop signing these electronic pads. When we go to hospitals, medical centers, and health providers, we're asked to sign consents for treatment and financial agreements to pay for the treatment. Okay, we're used to getting handed sheets of paper with a lot of fine print, but they were paper. You could protect yourself from making a commitment to pay whatever the medical facility just wanted to charge you by finding the section that talks about getting bills. So here I have a paper from a hospital center, and it says patient accounts department, billing department, understanding your bill, physician charges, blah, 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 physician billing, billing, charges. Okay. This is the point where I know that they're saying we can bill you for whatever we want. You're agreeing to sign here to say that we'll agree to, you're rather going to agree to what we decide is appropriate payment for the treatment that you were given. So folks got hip to this and they realized that they could protect themselves by Xing out anything that had to do with financial services, billing, basically crossing out anything that is in the financial jargon section is what I call it. And then write in this, I agree to appropriate treatment and charges up to 2x Medicare rates. Initial where you crossed out the writing that relates to financial and billing issues and sign at the bottom and you're done. Now folks started getting hip to the fact that this is something that's needed to be done, meaning write in, cross out anything that has to do with financial terminology and write in, quote, I agree to appropriate treatment and charges to up to 2x Medicare rates, or I consent to appropriate treatment and charges up to 2x Medicare rates. They realized that they needed to do this to protect themselves because by federal law, the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, debt collectors have to be able to show a signed financial agreement to be able to come after you at any point in the future for any debt they claim you owe. Now, this is the problem. Fast forward to the 21st century. Healthcare facilities, hospitals, medical centers, medical providers, and systems are asking you to sign these electronic pads, which number one, is connected to nothing. The first problem is it's connected to nothing, right? They're just connected to the receptionist or clerk's device. And that's it. It's just, otherwise it's just floating in the breeze, right? And the problem with this is that you don't know what you're signing. They say that they've given you your notices, the responsibility of telling you that you're agreeing to their verbal statement that you will agree to pay whatever they feel is appropriate charges for your treatment. They also say, well, this is part of your Privacy Act, the HIPAA Act. Privacy notices require that they're required to tell you by law, to give you notice by law. That's the HIPAA law. Privacy meaning that you have access to everything that involves your medical care from a provider, including financial information, and that they have to keep it private. They have to keep it safe from other people that don't need to have access to your health information. The other thing that this is really problematic, signing these electronic pads, number two, and this is actually most important, is that it prevents you from being able to X out, cross out the commitment to pay section and to be able to write in, I agree to appropriate treatment and charges up to 2x Medicare rates. You sign this, you sign an electric pad, that's it. You've just given the entire medical system, the folks that treated you, and gave you your medical care a signed blank check. So years down the road, they or whoever they sell your alleged unpaid bill to, according to the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, can come after you in court to garnish your wages and just devastate your entire financial future. But we're stopping this now, today. From now on, when you're at a medical care facility and you're pointed to this to sign, stop everything. So what I find what's been happening, what's usually happening, is that you're in the post-COVID era, you are talking to a clerk who's signing you in and having you sign paperwork without papers. And they're also behind a mask, they're wearing a mask, and they're behind a plastic COVID protection shield or guard, right? And so they'll say, sign here, and point to the electronic signature pad. In my experience, that's all I hear. I hear blah, 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 blah. And I know they're supposed to, by law, be giving me my rights, notices of my rights, according to the federal law called HIPAA, in terms of my rights to my records and privacy of those records, and the right to have information about the charges that I'm going to incur by getting treated at this facility. So this is what I know they're supposed to be telling me, but I know that no one, if I'm hard of hearing, I understand that I may hear less than other people, but come on, really, even if you have perfect hearing, they're behind a mask, you can't read their lips, and behind a plastic shield, what are you really going to be able to hear? And they're saying, okay, well, we gave you your notices verbally, so you've agreed to this by signing this electronic pad connected to nothing, and you're not able to dispute and say, no, I don't consent to whatever you want to charge. I consent to treatment and charges for this treatment up to 2 times the Medicare rate. So what you're going to do is, from now on, this is what we're going to do. When you go to a medical care facility and you're pointed to the electronic pad, blah, 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 sign here, you're going to stop everything and politely ask for a paper printout of what they're asking you to sign. And they may say, well, it's going to take us a while, I understand. You know, there's always going to be an excuse. There is no excuse for you being able to, by law, have your notices given to you in writing. Period. If you want it in writing, you can have it in writing. Ask for a printout of what they're asking you to sign. Let's go back to old school. Cross out the sections that appear to be related to financial agreements and billing, and write in this: I agree to appropriate treatment and charges up to 2 times Medicare rates, period. That's it. Just because someone or a medical facility may be saving your health or even your life doesn't mean you should allow them to kill your financial future. Don't let this keep happening to you. It stops today. It stops today. It stops today.
Thanks for tuning in to today's show. We hope we have given you some helpful tips to guide you through your medical journey. Until we talk again, have a beautiful week.